You're listening to Vitamin PhD, a podcast from Boston University delivering career narratives and know-hows to supplement your doctoral studies.
Welcome to the Vitamin PhD podcast. This is our season on self-awareness and what it means to practice that core capacity in our graduate and professional lives. I'm Grace McGowan, a doctoral candidate in American and New England Studies.
And I'm Thachita Pichardo, a doctoral candidate in molecular and translational medicine.
Today, we're excited to be chatting about how we can use self-awareness as we navigate academia and managing long-term projects.
Our guest today is Dr. Hannah Chulik-Baird, who is an assistant professor of classics at Boston University. And we're so happy to have you. Hannah, do you want to introduce yourself and give your sort of introductory preamble?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. Thank you both for having me. It's great to be here. As Grace said, I'm a professor here at Boston University in the Classical Studies Department, which means ancient Greece and Rome for the most part. I'm Scottish and Czech, actually, but Scottish and Czech. I did my undergraduate work at Oxford University. I did my PhD at the University of Southern California, and I've been a professor at Boston University for the last 5 odd years. So my research specialty is on Cicero, who is an ancient orator, Latin orator, as well as intellectual and general man of letters. And essentially my research around him in the last few years has been about his quotation of Latin poets from the previous century and his role in preserving those Latin poets as fragments. So this is my interest has been about how do fragments get made in antiquity and preserved into modernity? And my book on this is Cicero and the Early Latin Poets is coming out with Cambridge University Press next year, hopefully April. That's me.
We'll put a link to your book and then any other sort of like projects and things that you have ongoing as well in that episode description.
I'm quite unfortunately for me, but I'm quite active on the internet on Twitter, on academic Twitter. So if you want to follow me there, it's at opietasanime, which probably is inscrutable, but if you Google my name, you'll find me. So and in talking about the self-awareness of this podcast, I talk a lot about both academic concerns but also the kind of, you know, the B side of academia, which I gather is the kind of interest of people listening to this. So
because this season is all about self-awareness in grad school particularly, but you know, in sort of life and academia more generally, the first question we always open with is we ask our guests what self-awareness means to them or how they see it working for them in their personal or professional lives, like sort of their own sort of self-awareness journey.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I think, you know, where my mind immediately goes to is basically, you know, thinking about how academia by its very nature is a kind of conservative place, right? In the sense that it presents a very specific kind of person as an exemplar, and that's how you are supposed to follow. You're supposed to be like that person, and that means both, you know, your research is supposed to look a certain way and you're supposed to act a certain way and you're supposed to look a certain way. And these things are really powerful, both on the imagination of the student and then also on the imagination of the broader public. And so naming that as a historical process and as like an active influence upon how we see ourselves is where I begin. And also, you know, just trying to think of late, how the way that I behave within this kind of environment needs to apparently line up with these expectations, but also often feels like it's not natural to me and it's also not authentic to me. And so I feel that tension very strongly. The self-awareness of it all is trying to unpack, you know, what parts of it do I want to keep for myself, the parts of the exemplar that I think are valuable, but also which parts of the exemplar do I want to kind of nibble away at, eat away at, maybe kind of be more corrosive towards, you know, trying to dissolve it, let's say, by virtue of being as authentic as I can. It's a very hard process because there's so much pressure around it, and it's sort of invisibilized, and it's also not necessarily discussed, and some people don't necessarily have the awareness or the language to discuss it. So that's kind of where I am here, which is that you know, it does for sure make you feel a bit like a neurotic person, but I get that kind of process of a self-analysis always working. But I tried to situate this within a broader kind of structural trend, let's say.
And so is that sort of self-awareness that you've had sort of as in your position in academia, and how that relates to long-held expectations, is that something that you started out with when you were sort of in your early career, or is that something that you've developed for yourself as you've sort of matured now into like a professorship? And if, you know, the latter is the case, sort of how did you really go about sort of developing that self-awareness, or what were maybe some of your first steps to sort of realizing that, you know, you as a person exist in a certain way and academia has certain expectations for how people should exist within that sphere?
Mm-hmm. I think that when I was an undergraduate, and that was at Oxford, as I mentioned, and that's very, very much the kind of Grace knows this, but like that's very much the, you know, the exemplar that I mentioned is very potent there. And I think I had a sense of difference, let's say, when I was an undergraduate, but I really internalized that difference as, okay, this is a competition and I can, if I work hard enough, I can fight it and win, right? I really felt that, naively, I felt that to be the case at the time, and I tried very hard. And so at that point, it was kind of internalizing it really and performing within it. And it wasn't until, I think probably quite further along in grad school, not in the beginning, because I still had that sense of, you know, competitive self-display in the beginning of grad school. I think it was once I actually started to engage with students that I had, excuse me, started to theorize this a bit more, because I realized this kind of interrelationality that happens with students means that you start to see that parts of yourself as a student in your students, and you also see your own responsibility to them. And then you're like, oh no, okay, I realized that some of the things that didn't work for me, now I have an opportunity to kind of expand on that or give some air into this situation. I think it really was probably when I started being a teacher as a graduate student, and for sure as a professor now, it's the teaching dynamic kind of that kind of brought this out, because I now kind of take the theory that I want to meet people where they are rather than trying to impose a particular structure upon them, because that way we can kind of, people can have a sense of growth out of wherever they are and using whatever their particular strengths are and their perspectives, rather than, you know, constricting into a particular shape in order to be visible to other people. So for me, it really, I think, got tied up in, I mean, these times, you know, we were just discussing off mic before we started about how, you know, you have to present yourself in grad school, you have to do these various kind of, you know, grant applications and, you know, presentations and things like that. You start to have a strong sense of what your image is at that time in later grad school development, at the same time as you're teaching students for the first time. And I think that kind of combination can give you a sense of, you know, okay, where am I in the history of this, and what small adjustments or maybe larger structural adjustments can I do that can bring this out? So I think, yeah, I think it really was this kind of interrelational relationship with the students that started to let this self-awareness bear fruit, I think.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, we've had a couple of conversations with other guests so far, and it has been, I mean, I guess like kind of amazing. Also, like it logically makes sense, like just how much community can like impact.
I mean, not everyone gets to that point, I think, is unfortunate, is that you have to be in quite a supportive environment, hopefully facilitated by community, to be able to identify the fact that difference is not inherently a negative space. So, but yeah.
Right, exactly. And also if you come from, I just am like reflecting on my own experience, if you come from sort of a different world than this one and never the two you ever meet. It's very easy to adopt this persona because no one's there to be like, so that's not you, because nobody knows what you're like in this other world. And I had an experience recently where I sort of entered, and everyone has this, you know, it's not necessarily deceitful, but I sort of entered into my sort of teaching persona. And one of my long, long term friends was in the audience watching me. And I was so aware of her watching me that I could feel myself modulating my voice and my accent. And also, you know, I was very self-conscious and self-aware of like how I was. It was a good moment for me to reflect on just how much of myself I have hidden away when I'm trying to perform professionalism or teaching or all of these things.
No, that's so interesting. I was speaking with, I think maybe my sister recently, and had a tone shift, and she's like, oh, here comes the teacher voice. You know, it's not, it just, there is a performance. That's certainly true there. And so, and it's not necessarily, I mean, everything is performative in different degrees, but, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing to have. It's actually natural that you have a teaching persona and you have an academic persona. And you should have a part of your life. I think this is where the question of authenticity becomes a little bit complicated, is that there should be part of your life that is yours and doesn't have to, you know, you don't have to disclose every single thing to everyone all the time. At the same time, I do think it's good for us to have elements of our personal lives and our full, whole, holistic lives coming into the academic role, because otherwise it just becomes very sanitized, and and that kind of sanitized world allows us to kind of be quite severe, and which is a barrier for good complicated things to be happening in it, you know, richness.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not to say that your sort of your teaching and your scholarship is not also a part of you. So you've written, you did your PhD in SoCal, and you've now written this book, which is very exciting and forthcoming. These are huge projects, right? And very, anyone who's in grad school knows, very independent projects. There's a lot of sort of time for introspection. We were sort of wondering if you could speak to like what you saw as like the biggest challenges in like managing these huge, like years and years long projects, and how self-awareness factored into that or didn't, or helped or hindered you in sort of thinking about managing those projects long term.
Yes. I mean, it's a great question. And writing is, the first thing I think that you got to say is that writing is very hard and it's painful, and you should know, everyone should know going into it that that's built into it. So when it's writing is hard, you shouldn't be thinking, oh no, I'm terrible. You should be thinking, oh, this is normal and this is, it's working, it's happening. You know, that's part of the experience. When I was beginning my PhD writing stage, I at the time had been, I have totally given up on this, but at the time I was running half marathons, and I had been, don't look so impressed because I really want to stress that I don't do that anymore. I had read Haruki Murakami, who's a novelist, has a book about writing, and that really makes a comparison between running and writing in the following way, which is that when you run, you don't say to your muscles, oh, get stronger, or, you know, be better or whatever. You just, or he does, not me anymore, but he goes out every day and runs and just sees what happens. And slowly over time, muscles develop, you know, stamina improves, endurance improves. And it's not at all, any of it is, none of it is on a conscious level, but rather it is simply happening. And it happens by virtue of a sustained practice. And writing is exactly the same way, which is that you put yourself in the circumstance to do it, in the position to do it, and you practice, you put yourself in your, that, like however many hours a day. I have to say that even having written these quite big projects, it's never been for me like masses of time every day. It's always been, I think, probably maximum 3 or 4 hours. So put yourself into that kind of position. And then you'll be surprised to see how it grows, right? So I think the challenge of it all is to, because, you know, you're thinking, how am I going to put together this massive thing? And you have to have a leap of faith, to be honest, and trust that you can do it. And then just simply do it, you know, and try not to neuroticize along the way, because that's really the part that is the hardest thing, is that every day that you sit down to write, you have to reckon with the difficulty of writing, which includes, you know, considering, having to consider who you are, because it's a reckoning with yourself every time you do it. And that's terrifying. And that's the biggest obstacle to it, to be honest. Everyone can do it if they have the material circumstances that support this kind of practice. Like, this is really my belief, is that anyone can do any kind of intellectual task that they want to, provided they have the support and provided that they do it consistently. I don't believe that people are inherently incapable of these things. But the trouble is that it is psychologically taxing, and you have to be able to be, so you have to be aware that whenever you sit down to write, put pen to paper, open your document, that you're reckoning with your image of yourself, and that you have to, like, you have to find your self-love in that moment to be able to begin and to be able to keep going. And so this is the tricky thing, is that going into academia can elicit a sense of self-hatred. And it's much easier to give in to self-hatred than to practice self-love. And of course, self-love is a very kind of nebulous concept. Well, on the one hand, it's practice, and it means, you know, if you continue at it for long enough, it will simply happen. It's irresistible in that regard. But then on the other hand, how do you deal with reckoning with who you are in the way that you write what you were writing? So that's a big challenge, and it just basically is the same challenge as every other part of life, which is, you know, who are you, and do you like who you are? And don't try to fix yourself by getting a PhD, because you're still going to be yourself at the end of it, right?
I think this idea that you've brought up of, like, a leap of faith and just getting started is so important, because I think a lot of us might be self-aware that, you know, myself included, I tend to procrastinate a lot, but I think there's always underlying issues as to why I'm procrastinating. So I'm putting together my thesis proposal, and I just could not get started, just, like, could not work on it. And I really had to interrogate sort of why I was so afraid of this project that I love so much and that I dedicate probably too much time of my life to, and sort of that feeling of, am I ready for this? Am I ready for that next stage? Do I have anything important to say or contribute? And sort of that relates to what you were mentioning of those feelings of, like, self-awareness, like that reflection that you have to undertake of yourself as a person, that's so much more than just the strict academic topic that you've chosen. And I think for myself in particular, in progressing to candidacy now as part of my program, I think I really had to reckon with that transition from a consumer of information to now a producer of information. And this was summarized really nicely by Edward J. Maloney and Joshua Kim, but essentially that struggle that a lot of PhD students have from taking in what's come before them with, you know, the abundant literature searches, to now how do you become part of that literature? And so I'm wondering if you have any sort of insight on that sort of transition there, or, you know, was it sort of all at once where you realized, you know, this is important work that I'm doing, I have something important to say, or was it sort of a series of small steps that you took, as you mentioned, just every day putting pen to paper?
Yeah, wow. Yeah, it's a great question. I think that's that switch from being, a consumer of information to the producer of information is something that is hard, and it must be gradual. And luckily, I think this is something that American PhD programs actually do quite well, because there's more of a kind of coursework element compared to, for instance, UK institutions. Is that they, although I don't know anything about STEM, so that's the other thing, is you'll have to tell me if that's wrong in STEM, if they throw you in the deep end more, but is that the idea is, at least from, I can speak from classics PhD perspective, is that at the beginning of your time, you're really finding your bearings. And for many people, many students that I'm currently advising, they have, their eyes are bigger than their stomach, and they love everything, and they really want to, you know, study everything that they encounter. And I think that's, on the one hand, that's awesome, because it just means that they're loving their life and loving what they're encountering. But it's also, you know, where do you find yourself in this is the question of it all. And so this is where I really, I think that there is a specific kind of feeling that you have when there's something that draws you to it, of curiosity, and actually desire is the word that I would use, where it has an irresistible pull upon you for whatever reason, and it feels different from everything else that you're reading or writing. And you also have a sense of urgency to it. And also you see yourself in relation to it very specifically. And then I did have a moment of just clarity, lightning bolt, where I realized that there was a lack around this research project that I mentioned about the fragments in Cicero. I just saw that it had not been studied systematically, and that it was kind of low hanging fruit. And that's lucky. I was lucky to have, you know, discovered that. But that happens often, is that despite the fact that there's so much written about so much, there are many, many details that are not parsed out. And there is, you know, you should never despair that you have nothing to contribute, because there is no perfect end to anything that we're doing, right? Everything is going to get more and more refined or looked at in a different way, or could be challenged in some way. This is a process that is ongoing. So this idea that there is a perfect state of knowledge that we're going towards is one that you should just erase from your brain completely, because that way you can see that in terms of us as producers of knowledge, you have to have a sense of humility here, which is that we're never going to know everything anyway. So what we're doing here is simply trying to find numerous pathways of interest that clarify the situation. And if you can come at it from that perspective, then yes, finding something which is a research project which is of interest to you, that sparks your curiosity, and it's also, you know, a reasonable scope. Because one thing that I feel quite deeply is that every individual observer of a problem will have something original to say, right? This is not often said, because people want to say, well, so-and-so scholar, famous scholar has already written about this. But what, imagine if, you know, you took one piece of scholarship or one body of literature, again, I'm a humanities person, so this is my wheelhouse, and you just had 10 people write their version of it, right? It would be so cool to see, like, how everyone has took their own, they all know what the literature of it is, but they're finding their own way through, and different things emerge, right? It's an emergent process. So there, have some faith in the fact that you have something new to say, regardless. You don't need to, yeah, there's a certain amount of kind of proving in academia, right? Prove to me that you are sufficiently skilled, prove to me that you're sufficiently well-read. But by virtue of doing your PhD, you're reaching that point ever more. And then at a certain point, now you're legitimately allowed to have something to say here, right? Like, again, it comes down to self-love and believing that you are, as a human being, have something to contribute. I think, you know, come at this knowing that everyone has, you know, their strength, and what is your strength? And again, you know, try not to invisibilize yourself and say, I'm only an observer in this, but rather take some authorship here. Think about yourself as an author and think, okay, I am so-and-so, and this is my take on it, right? So like a little bit, not too much arrogance, but still a little bit of, you know, sense of self in there.
Yeah. And I mean, this, it also really matters in terms of, you know, increasingly we're moving towards the aspects of positionality that politicize this invisibilizing of the self. It's like, oh, you can't really hide anymore. Like, it is going to be important who you are and where you stand in relation to the things that you work on. We're increasingly coming to recognize there's no objective standpoint. There isn't anywhere you can stand on this project that is objective. You're always going to be positioned in a very particular way. And it's, you know, it's no longer good practice to try and hide that, at least in my view, to try and like remove yourself completely from that kind of thing. And that doesn't mean you have to pontificate on, like, you know, I have the one true key to knowledge and I know this thing, but like, it is important, like, who you are and like how you're coming at things. And so, you know, these things that we've sort of been discussing have been the sort of the wrestling with the self that goes on when you're doing these sort of huge long-term projects. But I'm interested in this sort of sense of self and self-awareness in receiving feedback, right? Because you write this thing and you can't hold on to it forever, right? Someone has to read it. How is your journey through sort of receiving feedback of all kinds? Like, what are some of your thoughts on that?
I'm a human being, so I don't love receiving criticism, but I hope I have developed more of a maturity around it, but I will admit that in the beginning it was very hard to bear. But partially because I think that, you know, as a practice, we can be a little bit more keyed into how we're treating people when we convey feedback. So I just want to acknowledge that, you know, I think that we can do a little bit better as academics about how we give students feedback, for instance. But in the end, you're trying to find something of value in it, for instance. When my book was being reviewed, the manuscript of the book before it had been accepted for contract, I had one of the anonymous reviewers had given, you know, many, many pages of feedback. And at that time I was just like, oh, I don't agree with everything that's here, and I'm going to navigate it and negotiate it and go through one by one, which was an excruciating process, obviously. On the other hand, I'm grateful to have received this care, and I kind of saw it in that light in that moment, because someone here has gone through my work carefully and examined my claims and assents to the premise, and now wants it to be as in as strong shape as possible. And so if you have someone who is in that position of kind of being a generous reviewer who can identify the weaknesses but also identify the strengths simultaneously and give you concrete useful advice, then that's, you know, that's a gift in itself. And that doesn't mean that it's not hard to receive, you know, it's always hard to receive critical feedback, but it is part of the kind of journey of an intellectual project, is that if things go through so much review until before you see the final product. I think everyone needs to be reminded when they see something in a journal, how many drafts did that person write before it was then sent to maybe even a different journal and it was rejected and ended up in a third place, whatever. There's a lot of review and revision and refinement that happens in academic writing that is also, you don't see it because people only want you to see the final version. So I'm on board with all of this. I find it painful, but also I like, not all reviewers are actually approaching your work in good faith, and that's where it gets to be quite tricky, is that you're trying to find interlocutors who are with you in your work, and that's not, unfortunately, in academia, that's not always the case. So what I would say, if that's your situation, remember that there are other people out there, and you can find, and you have a community, and you make your community, and you can find people who are the right audience for you. And just because the first time there it doesn't work out, you can keep going to find them. That has been my experience, not with the book, but with articles. I've had situations where I've had to move around until I found the right venue, and it took longer, and that's frustrating, but in the end it came out, so that was good. And so that's the internal kind of academic side. But I think, Grace, are you referring more to kind of public facing work, such as on the internet?
I mean, if you want to speak to that, because I think that that's a kind of, at the end of like a long term project, if people are interested in publishing, like, you know, things do sometimes come out in a way that, you know, not just your advisor is the person who's reading it, right? There are people who you don't know, and sometimes not even necessarily people who are in your particular subfield. And I'm asking because I myself feel an awful lot of vulnerability around this particular thing. This is something that makes me very nervous.
As I'm in this kind of slightly uncomfortable position right now of having finalized the manuscript, but it's not out in print yet. And so I find myself, I think that what's happening psychologically is that I keep trying to write new articles because I'm trying to overwrite myself. And I don't recommend this during this kind of pandemic era that we're in, but I understand, I think that that's basically, to be self-reflexive, I think that's what's happening, is I'm thinking about this, presenting this, official piece of myself to the world, where once it goes out into the world, it's, there's no changing it, is certainly very uncomfortable. But you know, you should know that everyone knows, well, the people who are lucky to have been through it know that a book is basically 2+ years old by the time it comes out in terms of the ideas. And so there is a sense of kind of, we all understand that this is a, that there's a certain artificiality to it, and that even though it seems etched in stone, there is a dynamism to it which can be filled in by, you know, your the way that you talk about it in public, or, you know, what talks you give around it, or what further articles you give. Is it, despite the sense there, nothing is forever anyway, right? Again, why am I so philosophical about this? But it's just like, and that's what's kind of exciting, because I had certainly had this image, or like, for instance, when I was in your position looking forward to, you know, the idea of having a book, I was like, oh, I'm gonna feel so awesome because I've got this book. And I do not feel awesome. I feel wretched, right? Like, basically, Grace, what you have described is how I feel on a smaller scale, because I don't have such wide readership. But it again, this is what I'm saying, is that when I mentioned before, don't do a PhD to try to fix yourself or actualize yourself, is that in my experience anyway, I mean, as it has brought me so much great, brilliant opportunities and brought me into great people, but I still feel the same as I have ever done. It didn't fulfill me in the sense of, you know, completing me, and neither does the book. Will the book, and there's more books to be written. I'm basically just trying to get to a point of gratitude with it, and obviously I hope people will like it, but it's their right to find things that they think are wrong with it, and if they do, I'll survive. And actually, in fact, not only will I survive, it's evidence of intellectual engagement. So, you know, in the end, what would be worse is if no one ever talked about it. In fact, you know, I think that there's some kind of, there's a fluidity to intellectual engagement that demands criticism from my audience. And that's the natural part of it. And so I guess I'm ready. It's very nauseating, but I'm ready. So I'll just be feeling terrible, but ready to receive it again. So, yeah.
Yeah, it is. There is something to be said about it. If these things that I write, if the thing that they turn out to be is that I make someone so angry that I'm so wrong, that it's like a catalyst for like a shift in the field, I mean, it's still pretty good, I guess. Like, it's good for the field. I mean, I might feel bad.
Actually, I think that's true. Is that in recent times, I mean, this might be news to people who listen to this who are in STEM, but maybe not news to people in the humanities side, is that classics is going through a massive shift right now, as we're kind of, well, some of us are trying to divest from various historical structures and to be self-aware, let's say. And so every time we engage with this, though, it takes a huge, it does bring up deep emotions in everyone. And so there we have had to kind of try to figure out, okay, if we're going to go forward with this, we have to recognize that the difficulty of it is going to be part of it. So I mean, you don't necessarily have to aim to provoke strong reactions with your research, but it might happen, especially if you're doing research which has historically not happened before, right? Is it, and so this might be the natural reaction. And that does, again, that's not an evidence of failure. It's, and maybe it's evidence of the deep need, right? But again, it's really horrible to realize that, because you would wish it to be, you would wish yourself to be able to be like, okay, well, I have this criticism, and the field goes, oh, all right, let's just adopt that. Let's think about this. And then unfortunately that tends not to be the case, right? And so understanding that there's a permeability to this and a back and forth, if we want to think about things in the long view, we have to realize that these feelings of discomfort, sitting with discomfort, is going to have to be part of our work life. And again, you know, this relates back to what I was saying about writing, is that there's inherently a discomfort to all of this, which is not a sign that you are wrong or bad to be doing it, but rather that's simply a mechanism of doing this kind of intellectual work. And also in these cases where if you do find yourself, writing towards an audience which has some hostility to you, this is where you need to find your community, you know, and so, and you will, by virtue of doing this kind of work, is you will attract collaborators to you.
So I'm hearing from what you're saying that sort of making use of this feedback and sort of engaging with your work in a self-aware way means letting go of a little bit, or a lot of it in some cases, of ego, in the sense of that I think in the humanities potentially you can benefit from positioning your work as maybe just one interpretation or one piece of a dynamically evolving canon. But I think in STEM, a lot of the time we suffer from like an over-objectivity where everyone thinks that their individual mechanism or paper is the right thing that's happening in nature and that this is how they've proved it definitively until the next paper comes along and does one extra experiment that says, no, that might not be the case, or this is really the right, you know, thing that's happening here in this super complicated sort of biological phenomenon. And so I definitely had that feeling of ego with my grant proposals where I'm like, this is my baby. I'm not accepting any negative feedback on this because it took 7 years off my life to write this. And like, this is correct. And then someone really close to me gave me like the most brilliant metaphor and was like, you're essentially telling people I'm building a boat, but I've never built a boat before. Can you help me find all the holes before I put it in the water? And it just transformed the way that I thought about my work and the way that I was receiving and interacting with the feedback that I was gaining from people who at the end of the day, like my committee, ultimately want to see me put this boat in the water and succeed. And so I'm hearing some of those common threads too, and sort of engaging with people in a humble and self-aware way and sort of recognizing that, again, like this individual project, while it might be, you know, the star of your world right now, is not the only thing you will ever work on, is not the only thing you will ever contribute, and it will continue to evolve.
Yeah, I think that's a great, great metaphor. I love that.
Completely changed my outlook, and I just so needed it in that moment. But I am hoping that if one person listening to this podcast is like, okay, you know, I can now accept feedback, or you know what, like, you know, I can deal with this, then.
It is like a balance. It is a balance between holding things lightly enough to be able to make changes, to sort of plug the holes. And also, I mean, I don't know, I definitely don't think that this is actually a widespread phenomenon in the academy, but I know from my experience, a lot of the people who I have read my work are very sensitive and sympathetic readers. And so a lot of the times they'll give me suggestions, but they'll also, in sort of a comment, they'll give me space to push back, because they know that there are probably things, not all of the project, but there are things that I'm sort of married to that I'm like not willing to compromise on. And then there are other things where I'm just like, accept all changes, like yes, that's fine.
Yeah, one thing that I hear from this metaphor and the general reflection around it is that it's hard to be humble when you feel vulnerable. And I think that part of the kind of psychology of going through graduate school is that you get like some people get attracted to the bravado as a defensive mechanism away from because of the sense of vulnerability that they feel, which is that someone will reject them or they won't make it in some way. And I feel, especially now, given the fact that, you know, the academic job market is so competitive and so impossible, that this kind of bravado maybe naturally would be amped up because of the sense of, you know, you're trying to hope that you can power through in some way and that maybe you will make it. And so it's really hard to hold the psychology of trying to make it through and also to be accepted and to find a community that's not, that takes, you know, accepts the premise of your work and then be humble enough to understand that the nature of any kind of intellectual endeavor is to find ways to complexify it and to enrich it. And that's essentially, in the end, what criticism is attempting to achieve is not necessarily negation, but rather a kind of bifurcation or something, right? A sense of kind of fractal breaking away from a straight line. So criticism needs to be heard. If basically you have a right to, as you say, Grace, you have a right to reject things which are not helpful, but also understand that your job is always to be complexifying. And, you know, the way that you deal with your criticism can be to take part of it, but not all of it, or to read against it, right, rather than to accept it, but not to necessarily negate it. There basically, is there a sense of negation? I don't know. I think negation is part of our projection of fear rather than actually what's happening. But again, I want to say, acknowledge the fact that all of the psychological stuff is inflected by the truth of the competition and hierarchy in which we exist, which is that we do need to find ways to distinguish ourselves. We do need to find ways to, you know, get the job or get the thing. And that means it's harder to be humble, and it's harder to be gracious, and it's harder to be generous, because we are living in an environment which actually emphasizes the idea of a scarcity, right? So it's harder because of that.
And that's a great sort of segue into like the sort of final sort of big question that we had, which is that one of the many sort of pressures, which is a new pressure, right, that has sort of erupted in the last sort of couple of years for grad students, is the pervasiveness of social media and this idea of a professional presence on social media. And, you know, talk about publishing. So just wondering about your sort of thoughts about, you know, being self-aware on the, especially the social internet, and graduate students who are maybe, you know, they're running professional social media, or they've chosen not to.
I mean, I think I chose to do it, and I did it when I was a graduate student, and I think I got tremendous professional benefit out of it. For instance, there are several talks and publication opportunities that I would have not got if I had not been there. And also there are some really significant professional relationships that developed through the kind of environment that we have on Classics Twitter. So at the same time, I think that everyone you have to trust your intuition in this, in the sense that it might not be for you. And I think there are plenty of people who feel that way. And if that's not you, then that's fine. There are going to be other ways that you make your networking. But if you do it, I think, you know, I think it can be very, very useful for showing what's special about you, in the sense that people can find what your day-to-day life is like, what your process is like. And also, say, for instance, you have a particular research project where there's some part of it which is easy to communicate in bite-sized pieces. That's so valuable. Like I, all the time, people who, for instance, Latin teachers, I remember I'm a classics professor, but like Latin teachers all the time have told me that something I tweeted about some aspect of the ancient world they brought into the classroom. And like, I did not set out necessarily for that to be the outcome, but in this instance, that's very powerful, because, you know, for instance, I think it was actually recently about Phyllis Wheatley, and it was really, Phyllis Wheatley is taught in a particular way, and Phyllis Wheatley was the first Black poet who was enslaved and brought to Boston and wrote classical poetry in a classical style. And I think it's really fantastic for people to be reading this when they're normally just reading Latin, things like this, right? They're like complexifying movements that are happening. So they're happening in a subtle way on social media that you can use. Like there's plenty of information there. So it's not just about self-display, but rather about you know, creating resources. There is a dark side to this, obviously, and in the sense that, you know, you're in an environment which is competitive, and also people will see you that maybe you're not thinking about, for instance, the broader field, right? And that brings with it certain things to be aware about, if you want to say about self-awareness. You know, I think professionalism is kind of a cursed word, in the sense that it usually enforces, you know, basically white norms, right? It kind of filters out things which are useful. At the same time, remember that people are looking at you through these traditional lenses of professionalism, and you got to be okay with them seeing what you're showing. So either that can make you super paranoid and fearful and you're like, okay, never again, and I'm deleting my Twitter account right now, or you learn to live with, okay, maybe I'm okay with certain people having, again, it's the same as the criticism piece, which is I'm okay with some people having the reaction that they're going to have, and provided I feel good about what I'm doing, that's nothing to do with me. And, you know, the consequences of my verbalizations online will hopefully create a community for me and access new things. But I mean, I think I would be irresponsible not to enumerate the dangers to it, you know, because it has been, I think, especially over the pandemic, there has been a kind of general souring on social media just because people have been unhappy and are right to be unhappy. So anyway, where do I stand with this? Which is, I'm still there. I'm, as I mentioned at the top of the program, but I do think that, you know, if you can use it to find community, use it to highlight what you're doing, use it to create resources. And if you do those kinds of things, I think it works very, very well. Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm not on Twitter, because I think it's kind of like what you were discussing about trying to find with regard to publications, like what is a good fit? And I was like, I don't think Twitter is a good fit for me. So I'm mostly on Instagram. It's like where, for whatever reason, I have found it to be a good one.
And you do it very well, right? And this is the thing, is that you, and people are on TikTok too, you know? And I think that anywhere where people who, so here's the thing, academics, traditionally, the whole thing has been about keeping this immense power and information within closed doors, right? That's the whole point of academia. Historically, so if you, even in those simple terms, I know it's oversimplified, but in those simple terms, if you consider that you're taking a little piece of that and putting it out in the open for anyone to see and to react to and to use in whatever way, like, that is at its core the powerful part of it. And this is where, if I wanted to be idealistic about it, this is what I think is really great. And I think because PhD students can get demoralized and that they think that they don't have any authority or power here, you can bring what you know and communicate it to a broader audience. And that's liberation, baby. Like, that's, you know, that's what we need more of. And learning how to do that, learning how to talk to different audiences in different ways is part of your job as a PhD student. And to some degree, like, refusing to, I would say, no matter what, if you don't use social media, still consider, how am I engaging with the public to whom I owe this knowledge? Because otherwise I'm simply hoarding it for myself and for others like me, right? I think in just like to broaden it out like that, to think about how do I make things accessible to other people? How do I put it in their line of vision? How do I stop it from being simply the people who have happened to be in this space with me have access to it? Those are still broader questions in and above the other kind of dynamics of the general toxicity of social media, right? I mean, I think that it's very hard because it's emotionally taxing and there's a lot of the fermentation of bad feeling. At the same time, it's still a quick and easy tool to transmit information which has been kept in locked away. So if you consider it like that, then maybe you might feel differently about it. Yeah, I'm kind of leaning towards, after, you know, a year plus of quite torment on social media, maybe I'm leaning towards, you know, find, there is a place of resources in the sense that events are always being publicized, new trends are being, you know, narrated. I just think, you know, since you put yourself in a place where you're able to receive updates about your field and you can find a way to see the new trends in that way. Yeah. And I don't know.
Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. This is great. I feel like we could talk and talk and talk. Like, there's just so much that we could chat about, but thank you so much.
What a wonderful and energizing conversation. That was Dr. Hannah Kulik Baird, author of the forthcoming book, Cicero and the Early Latin Poets. Check out the episode description for links to her work, as well as other helpful resources. We hope to see you next time.